Good morning, everyone. I see that folks are still getting documents, which is fine, but we need to get started here. So if you could do that quietly, we would appreciate it. So I'm going to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Glad to see everyone here today. We've got a lot of work to get through. And the first order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Bierman.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move to approve the minutes of March 7th.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Is there any discussion to the minutes of March 7th? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you. And I don't know if I said, but a quorum is present. So, 1 minute here. Okay, so the first bill on our agenda today is House File 1700. Representative Feist is here. I just want to say a word about this because I know there's quite a bit of controversy around this bill, and we do need to be pretty efficient with our time today. So when we get to testifiers, we have asked proponents and opponents of the bill we've given each of those sides 15 minutes to divide up as they like. And so what we're going to do then is when we have the proponents, we have five testifiers. So each of those will get 3 minutes apiece. If that side wants to divide the time differently than that, just let us know. We can divide it differently. And similarly with the opponents, we have seven testifiers. So we're going to give them approximately 2 minutes apiece. So, and then we have some other testifiers as well. So first, I will move House File 1700 to be re-referred to the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. And then Representative Feist, you have an author's amendment, I believe.
Yes, Madam Chair, I do.
And that is the A4 amendment. And so I will move the A4 amendment. Representative Feist, did you want to move it right now?
I believe it's the A3 amendment.
Oh, sorry.
It was, they switched, there's an updated version.
So it is the A4. Okay, let me just check with House Research. Right. It is the A4 amendment. I guess there was an update from the A3. So this is your A3 updated. So, but you did want to adopt that right now, right? All right. So I will move adoption of the A4 amendment to put the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A4 amendment is adopted. So, Representative Feist, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1700 is the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act. The goal of this bill is to address the unacceptable status quo where both nurses and hospitals are currently struggling. Data and a recent report by the Minnesota Nurses Association showed that 2,400 MNA nurses left the bedside hospital job last year alone. That is a retention crisis. It means that veteran nurses are retiring early, taking years of experience with them, including a nurse in my own district. It means that new nurses are being turned away from a career that they spent years training and educating themselves to come to, only to find that it was not what they signed up for. The number one reason that nurses identified for why they left the bedside was insufficient staffing, followed by related issues of stress, management challenges, and poor working conditions. These responses were mirrored when nurses were asked about the top issues that needed to be fixed in order for them to return to the hospital. Nurses listed improved staffing as the most critical issue for nurse retention. I've heard stories of pelvic exams being performed in hallways, patients returning to the hospital a day after release due to insufficient instructions at their discharge, and early retirement due to multiple violent patient incidents per week without an end in sight. There is no shortage of nurses in Minnesota. In 2022, there were more than 122,000 registered nurses in Minnesota, an increase of more than 4,000 over the previous year. We come armed with methodically collected data, from nurses statewide to paint a concrete picture of a situation that urgently needs to be addressed and how to address it. So here's what this bill does to create a comprehensive approach to staffing. It gives nurses a voice in staffing at the hospitals where they serve on the front lines. It creates transparency that will help patients and healthcare workers make informed decisions. It addresses workforce shortages through multiple approaches, including loan forgiveness, recruitment of nurses and nurse educators, and solutions to the increasingly regular occurrence of violence in hospitals. Here's what this bill does not do. It does not create strict ratios. It does not create rigid hospital-wide staffing plans that are unresponsive to regular changes at the unit level. The staffing committees and workload committees will function in tandem with nurse leadership and do not replace their decision-making power. I want to thank the hospital stakeholders whose input has been incorporated into the entirety of the bill except for Article 2, which is the staffing section. The amendment that we adopted today was in its entirety the very helpful granular input that the hospital stakeholders provided and which we accepted and think that the bill is improved for it to make it more workable for hospitals. The conversations are ongoing and I appreciate them. I want this bill to be workable. I've heard in great detail how the status quo is not working for nurses, it is not working for hospitals, and we have an opportunity to do something about it. And I'd just like to reference my visual aid. These are the Concern for Safe Staffing forms that have been submitted to the Minnesota Nurses Association, and they provide a lot of detail about situations where nurses have expressed their concerns for their patients, for their licenses, and have not felt that they have been heard, and so they've submitted these forms. And with that, I will turn it over to my task flyers. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Feist. And I just would like to point out to members, in your packet, you have a document that is coded at the top, 1700 UEI. That is an unofficial engrossment, so you should work off of that. It has in it the amendment that we just adopted. So I'm looking to House Research if that is that correct, Ms. Clactis?
Madam Chair, that's correct, except it does not include one correction.
Okay.
On page 9, I think it's line 16, there should be a not after is. So page line 916, the commissioner is not required to verify compliance.
Okay. Did everybody get that? So this... Now, we're not amending anything here. This is just, Ms. Clarkvist is pointing out, they did this unofficial engrossment. It just needs a change to be completely accurate. So again, on line 9.16, it says the commissioner is required. It should say the commissioner is not required. So other than that, we could be working off this engrossment that's in your packet. So thank you, Ms. Clarkvist. All right, so we will go to the first testifier. And just to reiterate, we're going to be timing our testifiers for 3 minutes, please. And the first testifier is John Welsh. And when you come to the table, please be ready, introduce yourself, tell us who you're with, and go ahead with your 3 minutes of testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Welsh, and I'm an RN at Unity Hospital in Fridley, where I've worked the last 12 years as a cardiac nurse on our tele floor. I love my job. I love working with our patients, but there are simply too many shifts where nurses cannot provide a safe level of care. Shifts where we go home wondering if we didn't spend enough time with a vulnerable patient whose condition may have been starting to deteriorate. Or the daily stress of helping one patient to the bathroom and then hearing the bed alarm of a confused patient go off and not being able to respond and just waiting for the seconds turn sometimes to minutes as the alarm continues, and you just hope that another staff member can respond before that patient falls. Or, and this has happened several times in the last months for me, where I have a patient who's alone and dying and no family at the bedside. And the ache in your heart at the end of the day that you just wish you had more time to make sure that man's final hours were as comfortable as they could be. These are the types of days that drive nurses from the bedside. At an earlier hearing, a legislator asked us why can't hospital leaders and nurses work together to find a solution to the staffing crisis. I can tell you clearly, we tried. During the last year, I served on Unity's negotiating team during our contract negotiations with Allina Health. Time after time, proposal after proposal, we were met with silence from the employers. For the first 8 months of negotiations, they did not present a single responding proposal on staffing. We made more than 24 different staffing proposals during the negotiations. In the final contracts, we did make some gains. At Allina, we outlined a process where a nurse could object to an unsafe staffing assignment. At mHealth Fairview, they gained a provision saying that floor staffing grids could not be worsened without the nurse's input. These are important, but they do nothing to reduce the overall staffing crisis we are facing. Hospital officials will blame the staffing crisis on nurses like me for working less than full time, but I simply was burning out. Too many horrible shifts, and I could not recover in time before the next. I have a part-time nursing job that pays less than my hospital job, but to me it's worth it because of the stress levels we face in the hospital. For our patients' sake, we need to fix the staffing crisis and let us nurses return to the bedside and focus on the jobs we love. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Diana Smith, and then followed by Laura Arnold. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. So my name is Diana. I've been an ER nurse in Minnesota for the past 15 years. In that time, I've been punched, kicked, verbally threatened, and spit on. My most recent assault involved a patient who wanted to go for a walk. I talked to security to see if they could take him for a walk. I was told because of a behavioral incident with them earlier in the day, a nurse would have to go along as well. We were already overloaded with patient care needs, and no one had a capacity to staff the walk. When I told the patient that we could not go for a walk right now, but maybe later, he became upset, and they went into the bathroom and started kicking the wall. I tried to talk to them and explain why we couldn't take him for a walk right now, and he made a fist and attempted to punch me in the face. I was able to block the punch and got hit in the neck. I subdued them and was able to get them into a room where there was a camera that someone should have been watching to send help if needed. However, nobody came to help me. I was able to get out another door and call for help for myself. That patient should have received a one-to-one nurse patient assignment. By policy, there is supposed to be someone assigned to support only them. If we would have been staffed for the one-to-one, we would have been able to take the patient on a walk, helping their mood, health, and recovery. If we had been staffed appropriately for this patient, I probably would not have been punched. However, when our units are constantly understaffed, we struggle to navigate complex care needs that sometimes result in violent behavior, putting nurses and patients at risk. Unfortunately for me and my patients, our hospital executives did not staff the patient appropriately and continue to understaff our units. I was assaulted almost 2 years ago and left with an injury that I have already had two surgeries for. The next time I get assaulted, I may be forced out of bedside nursing. I do not want to leave the bedside. I want to be safe at work, and I want to provide my patients the safe, dedicated care they deserve. There is no other profession where violence is acceptable. So why is it okay for healthcare workers? Please help our current and future generation of nurses stay safe by passing the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Laura Arnold, followed by Rachel Hanneman. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Laura Arnold, and I've been a practicing pediatric nurse for over 15 years at Children's my entire career. I absolutely adore my patient population and my job. But recently, over the past few years, we have observed two overriding themes in our hospitals. Patients being admitted have been increasingly complex care needs, while at the same time, executives tout the values of lean management practices, essentially expecting nurses and caregivers to do more with less. The combination of these two factors has led to a disturbing and unsustainable situation for nurses providing care at the bedside. Nurses are the doctor's eyes and ears at the bedside and are relied upon to provide accurate and timely assessments of patient conditions so providers can make informed treatment plans. All of this requires targeted training and continuing education as treatment protocols change, as well as mentorship from more experienced nurses to develop assessment skills and the nursing intuition abilities. Due to low staffing levels, nurses are pressured to take on assignments that are too busy and possibly above their current skill levels to provide safe care. Experienced nurses like myself often feel the burden heavier because we feel responsible for helping others with their patient assignments on top of an already complex assignment. I work on a floor with patients having complex physical and behavioral health care needs, some exhibiting physical aggression. We have had staff members physically injured, concussions, injuries involving them needing emergency medical treatment, and suffer emotional trauma due to not having enough resources and staff to provide safe care. It is the nurse's responsibility to determine whether they can provide safe, competent care when accepting an assignment. When nurses are pressured to accept more than they can handle safely and lack adequate resources or time to complete tasks and meet expectations of patients and families, it is only a matter of time before something goes wrong. Help us stop preventable harm. We need your intervention now. Please pass House File 1700. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Rachel Hanneman, followed by Carrie Mortrud. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, my name is Rachel Hanneman, and I've been a nurse in Minnesota hospitals since 2013, with much of my time serving at Fairview. I began as an LPN in 2013, worked as I went back to school for my bachelor's in nursing and became an RN, and even volunteered to work at the Bethesda and St. Joe's COVID ICU. I'm here today to share with you the frustrating lack of voices that nurses have in both staffing and retention in Minnesota hospitals. After the ultimate untimely closure of Bethesda and St. Joe's COVID ICUs, I transitioned to work at the SICU at Hennepin Healthcare. I needed weekends only, night shift especially, as that allowed me to be compliant with my parenting schedule as a single mother. Unfortunately, hospital management does not always make decisions that encourage nurses to stay at the bedside, and my role at Hennepin was extraordinarily brief. Due to my unforeseen family dynamics, I needed to shift my schedule, but as a new employee, I did not have FMLA. Knowing that night and weekend shifts were often the most difficult to fill, I suggested that I move to casual status, which would allow me to pick up night and weekend shifts within my same unit without jeopardizing my attendance or my employment. Because of the difficulty in filling these shifts and my dedication to staying in the same unit that I was already trained on, I was shocked when the hospital denied this request, and rather than keeping a trained nurse who was willing to pick up these shifts, they instead opted to have me resign. Shortly after, I reached out to a staffing agency and asked for the same schedule I was requesting at Hennepin Healthcare. Because of the huge demand for nurses willing to work weekends, it only took a few weeks before I was hired, credentialed, and cleared to start in a different hospital within the exact same state with the exact same schedule I was asking for. This hospital, along with many others in the state, was forced to pay significantly more money to a staffing agency for me to contract with them, when in reality, I was a nurse who wanted and was ready to work for the most fragile patients in the state and directly for a hospital. All because of the inflexibility and lack of retention-minded policies within the hospital, this was the way this went. Unfortunately, I'm now back in the same situation. My desire to work directly for a hospital rather than a staffing agency brought me back to one of my former employers. Because of my single parenting schedule, I have again requested to work weekends, night shift, and have expressed eager readiness to float from unit to unit each shift. I reached out to my manager and then to a different manager within the same hospital. My manager has twice told me that they are not in need of this role, and the other manager ignored my email request. Yet at one time, at the time of this writing, there were 26 open shifts on Sunday night alone compared to 18 shifts on Monday night. There is no doubt that the hospital needs nurses to cover these shifts, but I fear that rather than working with nurses to retain them, yet another hospital will choose to have me resign and again replace my position with another, more expensive staffing agency nurse. It's clear from my experience and those of my fellow nurses that the hospitals are not listening to us when it comes to retention and staffing. The nurses on my current unit would be extremely relieved to have another nurse work on these weekends and night shifts when we are still short-staffed. Yet hospitals continue to ignore our requests and prove that unless legislation forces them to listen to us, they will continue to ignore us. By passing this bill, you give nurses a voice in improving conditions in the hospitals for all of nurses and all of Minnesota patients. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Carrie Mortrud. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Carrie Mortrud, and I gave up bedside nursing over 18 years ago for one reason. I couldn't safely care for my patients. That moment I gave up is one I'll never forget. It was when I was told to put one of the two cardiac patients I was caring for in the hallway in a wheelchair with a telepack because I was receiving a third. It was then that I knew something was seriously wrong with bedside nursing. Hospital bedside nurses are in crisis. They are pleading for the real solutions that the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act provides. However, after my testimony, you will hear about how this legislation is only going to cause further issues with staffing and financially harm hospitals. Yet research shows that safe staffing levels increase the quality of patient care. Federal Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality funded research which found that increasing the number of patients per nurse is commonly associated with higher rates of non-fatal adverse outcomes such as pneumonia, shock, cardiac arrest, and urinary tract infections. Opponents also state that meeting the legislation requirements will financially harm hospitals. Yet another study in the Journal of Healthcare Finance by Harless and McHugh titled Nurse Staffing Quality and Financial Performance determined that increased staffing of RNs does not significantly decrease a hospital's profits, even though it boosts their operating costs. Other false narratives the hospitals spread are this bill will make the emergency room worse, this is a ratio bill, this bill will kill patients, but this bill will make the crisis in the emergency rooms better, as the inpatient units will have the staff they need to admit patients being boarded right now in our emergency rooms, even in hallways. This bill is not a ratio bill. This is a comprehensive approach that gives nurses a say in staffing at their local hospital. Nurses can be disciplined if they simply put a patient at risk, but they have no decision-making authority to ensure that the right number and skill of nurses is scheduled to ensure that safety for the patients in their care. And finally, this bill will provide better care to the patients already admitted to our hospitals that have a false sense of security that there are enough qualified staff to care for them. Each year, hospital administrators come to you and ask you not to interfere with their business and leave the decisions up to them. As you heard from John, they struggled and struggled over the last year in negotiations. Again today, nurses are asking for you to intervene. The old way of doing things isn't working. MNA collects the Concern for Safe Staffing data from nurses when in their professional judgment, they believe patients are at risk for being harmed or have already been harmed. The most recent data showed that nearly 90% of the time nurses sounded the alarm, there was no response on the other end. How many nurses must leave before we are heard? How many patients must suffer substandard or even seriously unsafe care before we are heard? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, that concludes the testimony from the proponents of the bill. We'll now move to the opponents of the bill. And again, we have allotted 15 minutes in total, so it's about 2 minutes per. So we'll be timing you for 2 minutes. And first is Kelly Hagan. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Hagan, and I'm the Chief Nursing Officer from Rainy Lake Medical Center in International Falls, Minnesota. I have 25 years of experience as a nursing leader, 16 years of experience as a floor and bedside nurse. While proponents of this bill will believe it will bring nurses back to the bedside, we disagree. Statewide, 57% of registered nurses are not working full-time, a full-time schedule. Hospitals across the state are accommodating this to allow nurses to have a better work-life balance, something that we are very happy to accommodate here at Rainy Lake Medical Center, where 35% of our nurses do not work full-time. However, we are still a hospital, and we need to provide exceptional care to all of our patients 24/7, 365 days each year, meaning that we need to hire more employees to fill those shifts. In Minnesota, there are over 5,000 vacant nursing positions. At Rainy Lake, we have more than 30% of our nursing positions open or nurses out on FMLA at any given time. We know that this workforce shortage does not simply boil down to staffing ratios. This is about patient demographics, care team experience levels, and acuity of our patients. Not all patients require that same level of care. Please understand that when the union spokespeople say this is not a ratios bill, the language in the bill says that the committee will be establishing a maximum number of patients that can be assigned to a nurse. That is a ratio, even if the word ratio is not in the bill. RN staffing ratios are not proven to alleviate the strain on the nursing shortage. California, as you well know, is the only state with mandated nursing staffing ratios, and that's been in place for nearly 20 years. California also has over 40,000 vacant nursing positions, the most in the country. Ratios are not helpful to quality of care either. In Minnesota currently, we rank fourth nationally for affordability, accessibility, and for health outcomes. California ranks 29th. At Rainy Lake Medical Center, if these ratios were in effect, we would likely have to close units or beds, reduce service, and not be able to serve our patients and our communities. Thank you for your time today, and I hope you'll take this into consideration as you determine this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Mary Beth Olson, followed by Tori Wagner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Mary Beth Olson, and I'm the Vice President of Acute Care Nursing Operations at Align Health. My responsibilities include developing strategies to address the acute care RN workforce shortage. Prior to this role, I was the Chief Nursing Officer at Mercy Hospital in Coon Rapids and United Hospital in St. Paul. I have over 39 years working as a nurse. My experience at the bedside includes med-surg nursing, critical care, and the operating room. Align Health and other metro systems just recently settled their collective bargaining agreements with the Minnesota Nurses Association, and the contract includes a mutually agreed to process for escalating and addressing staffing concerns real time. The contracts are exceptionally generous despite the health system's extremely fragile financial state, staffing and supply costs rising, and reimbursements remaining flat. However, we knew this was what we wanted and needed to do for our nurses. Align Health is opposed to Article 2 of this bill as it moves staffing to a decision made by committee that does not allow real-time decision-making and flexibility nor accountability to the cost of care or workforce challenges. The committee is not charged with using any guidelines, standards, or benchmarks in identifying staffing grids. The bill asks for a committee to meet quarterly and decide the nurse staffing ratios, yet the committee has no accountability for those decisions. Align already has a committee and a grid review process, giving a voice to nurses to provide feedback on the staffing levels. Our teams have a daily huddle and frequent real-time conversations with our staff nurses and those working as a charge nurse to make those staffing decisions as needed. Patient acuity can change quickly, and the flexibility to respond rapidly is necessary. In a time when we already have overcrowding of our emergency departments and are boarding patients for many days, some days it's necessary to rearrange our staffing within the departments to make sure all patients are receiving the highest quality of care. A ratio would not allow for the individualization of care and real-time problem solving in which nurses and the rest of the care team are trained and equipped to do. We ask the committee to oppose Article 2 of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Tori Wagner, and followed by Sarah Gabrick. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for your time today. My name is Tori Wagner, and I am a registered nurse. I'm also the Director of Nursing for the Hospital and Emergency Department at Manoman Health. We are a critical access hospital with a 5-bed ED and a 10-bed hospital located on the White Earth Reservation in Manoman. Our nursing team consists of two nurses each shift and a nursing assistant on most shifts. Like many of the critical access hospitals in Minnesota, our nurses wear many hats. We provide inpatient, observation, swing bed, emergency, and outpatient services to our rural community. A few weeks ago, there was a patient that sat in our ED on three different life-saving medications for over 24 hours because several hospitals could not accept this patient. We ran out of two of the life-saving medications, and I drove 142 miles round trip in a blizzard to replenish these medications. My nurses and myself work together to ensure there is adequate staffing during this time, as we routinely do. This patient ultimately was transferred out and survived, but the next one waiting in our ED because a nurse has failed to accept a patient assignment may not. We are not equipped nor ever intended to keep these critically ill patients in our ED. Our nurses are passionate about serving our community and providing quality care. I have empowered my nurses to make real-time decisions about staffing and to call in extra nurses, nursing assistants, and an extra body when they need. We don't need committees and additional meetings to bring nurses back to the bedside. Rather, let's look at alternatives like team-based nursing models, staffing according to patient acuity rather than ratios, affordable college tuitions, daycare assistance for nurses, and violence prevention activities to help keep nurses at the bedside. Article 2 is written as a one-size-fits-all, but it is not the right size for the rural and small hospital. Our care team, including nurses, nursing assistants, lab, x-ray, nursing home staff, and administration, rallied together in times of high census or high acuity patients, ensuring our patients receive quality care. One of my very experienced and skilled nurses said it best about this bill when she said, "The places with the least resources will carry the biggest burden."
Thank you for your testimony. Sarah Gabrick, followed by Rochelle Schultz. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Sarah Gabrick, the Chief Nursing Officer at Winona Health. I have been a nurse for 37 years, 12 of those in direct patient care. We are a 49-bed rural hospital with the next nearest hospital nearly 30 miles away. We use daily staffing huddles to make staffing decisions in real time, allowing flexibility to adjust staffing and respond quickly as patient needs change, including staffing needs of patients boarding in the emergency department. Staffing ratios will not allow quick problem solving, real-time flexibility, and staffing adjustments that are crucial to meeting the changing needs of our patients. Passing this bill will severely limit our patient admissions and ability to deliver care, resulting in larger backlogs and patient care delays. In addition to the staffing committee, Winona Health would need six additional committees to meet the one committee per unit requirement, which would pull staff from the bedside and add even more pressure to an already stressed workforce. This bill suggests arbitration as a solution to resolve staffing challenges, which would delay response time to patient needs and add cost. Article 2 is not only creating a staffing ratio, it is a rationing of health care. It will be a first-come, first-served model of care. That model will not work in Minnesota, where patients have come to expect exceptional care. One of our values at Winona Health is that everyone matters. Our community relies heavily on us. We are their hospital. Winona Health adjusts the best we can with the limited resources we have to deliver on our mission, vision, and values. While registered nurses are critical to our care team, nursing assistants, licensed practical nurses, respiratory therapists, pharmacists, physicians, and many others are equally important in providing team-based and comprehensive care. This bill is not right for Minnesotans. It will negatively impact the care we can provide. Please oppose Article 2 of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Rochelle Schultz, followed by Adam Carlin. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Rochelle Schultz, and I work at Winona Health, a nonprofit independent community hospital where I am the president and CEO. And it's our privilege to serve much of Southeast Minnesota's needs. Our health system is in dire need of more workforce and financial relief. We ended our 2022 fiscal year with an operating margin of negative 3%. This isn't due to mismanagement of funds. This is due to exponentially rising costs for labor, medications, and medical supplies necessary to serve our patients, as well as the inadequate reimbursement that we receive from government plans, which is far less than the cost of providing care. Also, due to workforce shortages all over, we are dealing with the inability to discharge patients to appropriate care settings, whether that be a nursing home, assisted living, home care, home, or even transfers to referral centers. The effect of patients staying in the hospital longer than medically necessary is our emergency department fills up and there are longer wait times for patients who need care. In my 35 years in healthcare management, I've never seen finances and projections so poor. While 2022 was tough, 2023 is projected to be worse, with a potential negative 6% operating margin. If enacted, this bill will make our financial future even more grim. To comply with the proposed rigid staffing protocols, we would need additional help, and there are simply not enough nurses to hire. We are still trying to replace travel staff with our own caregivers. From the pandemic, we know how expensive staffing agencies are, and that is not a viable option for us. This leaves us with the only other option of shutting down units and services. And units and services are already being closed or the number of staff beds reduced due to the lack of workforce in many rural locations. It is estimated that over 70,000 Minnesotans would be unable to access care if this bill were enacted. And I'm disheartened to say that many Southeast Minnesota patients would be part of this number. Please oppose Article 2 of this bill to save rural hospitals in our state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Adam Carlin, followed by Mary Krinke. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Adam Carlin, and I'm the Clinical Nursing Director for Critical Care at Park Nicollet Methodist Hospital. I have a doctorate in board certification in nursing leadership and have spent the last 8 years as a nursing leader and the prior 6 years as an ICU nurse. In my role as a nurse leader, I often find myself caring for our patients while also caring for our healthcare system. I put my heart into nursing the system back to health, but just like for patients in our hospitals, a massive dose of the wrong medication will lead to a crash. Article 2 of this bill is just such a harmful dose. I appreciate the urge to act, but I'm here today because this legislation was developed with the deliberate exclusion of hospital nurse leaders. While there are innovative elements in this bill, such as addressing violence, loan forgiveness, and funding for mental health services, I can assure you that Article 2 of this bill would lead to a catastrophic spending and administrative burden with no promise of added value in care. We oppose Article 2 of this bill as it threatens to replace our existing staffing committee with an impractical, one-size-fits-all legislative mandate. Methodist is a union hospital and has a long-standing staffing committee responsible for reviewing staffing department plans and addressing staffing concerns. I myself am an engaged member of that committee, and I'm disheartened to see the concerns for unsafe staffing forms here at the table, because for the last 6 years at Methodist, we requested those forms from the Nurses Association and were denied access. In the last decade, not one of our annual staffing plans developed with nurses and nurse leaders has been contested through an existing process. Make no mistake, by passing this bill as written, you are taking the extreme measure of authorizing every staffing committee a direct path to mandatory staffing ratios. Every Minnesotan needing hospital care will be reduced to a number, and if the math equation of patients and nurses doesn't add up to an arbitrated number, Minnesotans will be denied timely access to care. You will not find any professional organization that advises rationing of care under such a first-come basis. Lastly, Article 2 directly conflicts with Medicare regulatory requirements of all Minnesotan hospitals that allocate ultimate responsibility for staffing to hospital nurse executives. So I ask you, under this legislation, who is ultimately responsible for hospital staffing? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mary Krinke, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I want to address two concepts in the bill that are particularly troubling. The first is bringing in arbitration to both resolve staffing level disagreements and when the staffing complaint forms can't be resolved within 30 days by the newly created workload committees. With the author's amendment that went on today, a separate workload committee would now be created for every unit of every hospital. Arbitration is a legally binding process in which the selected arbitrator makes a binding decision. Patients' needs are constantly changing. This would move staffing out of the hospital and decisions about staffing out of the hospital and eliminate real-time staffing decisions that adjust to patient acuity. The second issue that I want to draw to your attention is language in the bill allowing nurses on a unit to vote regarding whether to accept an additional patient on that unit. Hospitals cannot serve their communities taking votes to determine whether or not a patient is allowed to be admitted. If implemented, hospital units will close and patients in the hospital emergency rooms will back up and access to care will be in jeopardy. We recognize that nursing is hard work and there are many challenges right now in hospital settings. As you've heard, patient discharge issues, emergency room boarding, healthcare workforce shortages, and yes, unfortunately, incidents of violence against our employees. Article 2 will create new problems of access to care, We are asking legislators to oppose just this portion of the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Okay, so now we will go to Lisa McConnell. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Lisa McConnell. I have the pleasure of being the Chief Nursing Officer at Vermeil Clinic Health System in Southwest Minnesota. And I would like to share some thoughts about nursing at Mayo and our observations with the language as presented today. I've been with Mayo for over 32 years and 3 years as the Chief Nursing Officer in the region. But I began my career as a staff nurse where I served at the bedside for over 13 years. It has been a rewarding career that allows me the opportunity to make a difference for others during some of their most vulnerable times. The guiding principle of Mayo Clinic is that the needs of the patient come first. Nearly 10,000 nurses, both registered nurses and licensed practical nurses, have taken the calling to work across our practices in Minnesota to serve our patients and ensure the primary value is met. As a leader in our organization, I can attest that serving the needs of our patients also means meeting the needs of our staff. Like all areas in our society, we struggle in healthcare as we face unrelenting demand for services, but are also experiencing a huge and growing workforce shortage, including but not limited to nursing. Several factors are contributing to the shortage: demographic changes driving patient needs, an aging workforce, burnout, and increasing violence against healthcare workers. We appreciate that this bill seeks to address some of those challenges, both with ongoing support for mental health resources for these nurses and loan forgiveness opportunities. And the bill addresses some of these issues through ongoing appropriations. You'll hear later from a couple of my colleagues at Mayo Clinic their strong support for trying to address the increased incidences of violence committed against healthcare workers, which includes our nurses. Mayo Clinic shares the goal of retaining nurses, but has concerns with the proposed approach, specifically the creation of committees to regulate staffing. Staffing appropriately is time-sensitive and patient-specific. Mayo Clinic utilizes software and real-time nursing input to adjust our staffing needs accordingly. A complex committee structure that sets staffing ratios is not well aligned to meet the needs of our staff or our patients. It is also duplicative of current tasks for nurses to provide input on staffing, which have proven to be more successful and dynamic. Thank you for allowing me to share these thoughts with you today.
All right, thank you for your testimony. So members, we will now go to the amendments. There are a couple of amendments in the packet. And I understand only the A1 is going to be offered, and does someone want to offer that? Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move the A1 amendment.
All right. Representative Schumacher, to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A1 amendment removes Article 2 from the bill. We've been hearing about that in the testimony this morning about the concerns with Article 2 and the staffing mandates that are put in there in hospitals. And those mandates include the new mandated staffing committee, the new mandated workload committee that is going to be formed on each hospital unit, the new mandated requirement of the maximum number of patients an RN is assigned, the new mandate which shifts staffing decisions outside of hospitals for arbitration, the new mandate of posting these staffing mandates, and the mandate of grading hospitals by an NDH report card that doesn't offer context for things like whether a hospital offers inpatient mental health services, which is going to impact the numbers that are being reported. In addition, this amendment removes a nurse's refusal of a patient assignment, which, when you draw that out, leaves a pretty troubling conclusion. What this amendment doesn't do, though, is remove any of the other pieces in the bill that we do appreciate and would like to see continue on: the workplace violence prevention, the nursing education loan forgiveness, reports on hospital staffing and funding for mental health programs for healthcare professionals. We do like those portions of the bill, and I would appreciate member support and ask for a roll call.
All right, there will be a roll call. So I have several members on the list. I don't know if those members wanted to speak to the amendment. So if we can speak right now to the amendment, and then we'll go to the bill after. Representative Quam, was it to the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The the concerns with this, all of the pros We're from a group that represents less than 1 in 5 of the nurses, less than 18%. And the ones that have concerns about this section, not the entire bill, but this section, are from across the state and represent many more nurses. And one of the concerns I had is the structure of where each unit would have a committee. Well, you take the total number of units, you multiply times the nurses that would be in the committee, and then multiply times the hours they'd be meeting. That's a lot of hours, thousands if not tens of thousands of hours, away from bedside for nursing staff. And that if we, a big problem that we have is the nurses shortage, and this section doesn't do anything, I feel, to take care of the nurses shortage. In fact, the best thing to do that would be to join their majority of the states in the country with the Nurses Compact. So I think this bill would be much improved by removing Section 2, and many good components of the bill are outside of Section 2.
All right. Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Backer, was it to the amendment?
To the amendment, okay. Yes, Madam Chair. This goes to the author. When putting together and putting your work into this bill, especially with Article 2, what of the critical care access hospitals in Greater Minnesota did you work with when you were drafting up the Article 2 of this bill, please?
Representative Backer, I think, you know, what I think what we'd like to do is, I think that more goes to the discussion of the bill. And if we're going to questioning the author, I think I would give her an op. What I'm trying to do is let the members speak and then go to her for a response on the amendment. But, you know, I mean, go ahead, Representative Feist. But, you know, that's what we're trying to do, just to get through the amendment, and then we'll have a more full discussion on the bill. Representative Feist.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. So this bill has been in the works since about 2008, long before I came to the legislature. Since I had the opportunity to step into the role of chief author this year, I have spent many, many hours speaking with hospital stakeholders about the bill. The amendment that we introduced today incorporates essentially all of the input that I found really helpful on kind of how we can ensure that this bill, minus Article 2, really can work for hospitals. I have solicited and continue to solicit and hope that we can continue the conversation about Article 2 because it is essentially incredibly important to the bill and how it will function. But I do really desire input and continue those conversations.
Go ahead, Representative Feist.
I was just going to say that perhaps my expert sitting next to me might have some additional specific response.
All right. Well, let's go back to Representative Backer, and he has the floor, and you know, we'll get through the amendment, and then, as I said, talk more to the bill.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I support this amendment. The concern that I have is, as several of you know, I volunteer as an EMT, so I take patients in the middle of the night to the Wheaton Hospital, Graceville, Ortonville, and of course, Sisseton in South Dakota. And there are several times that I become part of the ER. So because of the staffing issues, many times I'm in the ER with the nurses, with the doctor, performing emergency care. And so the reason I agree with Representative Schumacher with his amendment here is I don't see how this would help staffing in these critical care access hospitals, which just in the state of Minnesota, I bring patients to 3. That would be my concern. So a metro delivery service is different, but at the same time, we all have the same concerns. It's patient care. And I'm a volunteer, and I jump in with part of the team. That's who we EMS people are. We help that patient. And I don't see how this would help my hospitals in my district and outside of the district that I serve, that I bring patients to. So I would share that with you, and I do thank you for answering that question. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Backer. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question, or the conversation, is to support Representative Schumacher's amendment. I think being a member of a very rural area of Minnesota, and most of my hospitals that are immediate are critical access upwards of 30 to 45 miles apart. Representative Schumacher's amendment would work so much better for functioning. And for those, I've had the privilege, members, of being in not only taking care of family myself, in hospitals here in the metro area. My grandchildren, twins, were born at Children's. So I got an up front row to see how that worked, but also the facts that happened in rural Minnesota were critical access. And I know someone mentioned the comment, you know, that you might be in the hallway. Well, I got news for you. 41 years ago, I was going to deliver our daughter, then daughter, this weekend, and I was in the hallway. There were no empty rooms, not even on the main medical floor. I tried to talk my husband into going home, but he wasn't taking any in-labor woman to the house for fear he might be delivering. Anyway, in the end, it worked out. It is the only time I've shared a room while I'm delivering a child, but that was the way it was. I did get a room, though, so there was a little more privacy. And but the reality is that stuff happens. You can't schedule that. No amount of nurses is going to fix that, and or bedside. And I think it is really important that we have nurses at the bedside. But it isn't possible to prescript this so well that we won't have any challenges or discussion about where people are going to go. And I can tell you that back in 2019, when my husband contracted Legionnaires and we needed to go from Crookston, a critical access hospital, to either Grand Forks or Fargo for dialysis because his kidneys had effectively functioned, sitting and waiting for somebody to decide where there was a space would have been a bad thing. When your physician, your internist, is standing there with you, pacing the floor because he's waiting for a hospital to call. And I didn't see that at the time. I just knew there were problems. That's pretty serious. And they finally decide, oh, by the way, there was a winter storm going on, too. Visibility in the Red River Valley is very bad at that point. So we ended up in Grand Forks because they could find a doctor, they could find a bed, and the nurses could handle somebody who was coming in critically. Didn't even go to the ER, went right to we were in surgical critical care, I guess. But my point is that I think we have to be careful that we prescript something for one hospital that will not work for some of our other hospitals. So I'm asking you, as the author of this bill, to seriously consider amendment the Schumacher Amendment so that we can define and also protect nurses. I all the other things in the bill, there are some concerns, but it also protects the staffing, and it's important. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we're going to go to Representative Bonner, then Nadeau, then we're going to go to the author so we can get a vote on the amendment. So because we do have a number of other bills to hear today, and I think probably a lot of people in the room are interested in us getting to those bills. So, Representative Bonner.
Thank you. And I'll thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to be as brief as possible. I just wanted to say, you know, I'm the daughter of a nurse, 43 years, ER, urgent care, cardiac critical care. And staffing is complicated, right? I mean, it is a little bit more of an art and a science, and that's what makes this issue so, so difficult. You know, it depends on what your census is. It depends on your patients. It depends on the experience level of your nurses on any given time at any given day. And it can be really, really challenging. But that said, and this is where I am really, really disappointed. And I oppose Article 2 because I think this conversation needs to continue. And I am really upset that we are pitting hospitals in greater Minnesota with hospitals in the urban core, that we are not actively thinking about what is best for patients, that we are not having a conversation about solutions. We are seeing positions where people are entrenched. I know that the nurses have changed this proposal over the years to try and make it more workable. And I don't know that Article 2, as it stands today, is the right answer. I'm going to be very frank about that. But the reality is this conversation has to happen, because some of the issues that nurses are bringing forward about staffing are legitimate, real issues that we have not addressed, and they must be addressed. And so for that reason, Article 2 needs to stay in this bill, because that conversation needs to be had. And we need all players at the table to have this conversation. And I will say there was one suggestion today that I would suggest to the author might be worthy of discussion. One of the testifiers brought up the point about making sure that nurse managers are part of the equation. If they are not, they probably should be. And so I just want to be clear, as someone who's had a role where I've listened to my mother herself have to make some of these staffing decisions for her folks. And she hated it. I'm not going to lie, because it's difficult. But it has to happen. And for the folks who are sitting here complaining about Article 2, then bring some options to the table. Bring some solutions. We can't just say no. We have to talk about what the options are and how to make Article 2 better. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And maybe this would be a good moment before I call on Representative Nadeau and go to the author of the bill. I would just like to explain that the path of the bill today, so the bill has to go to the Labor Committee, so we will be voting on the bill, but our intention is not for this bill to go to the floor by itself. The intention is to have it in the omnibus bill. So I just want to make clear to everyone in the room that we will continue to work on the bill. I believe that is the author's intention. So this is in no way considered to be a final product as it is here today. So with that, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't going to speak to the amendment and just support its adoption, but I wanted to thank Representative Schumacher for bringing it, because the heart of the bill, and I understand it's Representative Feist, this is the main part of your bill. But we've heard lots of testimony about how it pits two sides against one another, almost in a not even more so, almost combative. And I really respect Representative Bonner's viewpoints on these things. And I do believe that we need to find a path forward. And I understand that this thing has been around for a long time, but I also believe that we should support removing Article 2 of this bill. And you keep working on this, because it's got, I mean, just for example, I'll just take, you know, on from page at line 10.7 to 10.32. I mean, we're basically having the, you know, for reporting noncompliance for some, even a patient, a staff, we're having, you know, mandatory investigations by the Commissioner of Labor. This is serious. This is serious. This doesn't help reduce staffing. This doesn't improve the situation for patients. And again, I don't understand why I got in here, but I do support Representative Schumacher's amendment, and I'll speak to the whole bill later. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the discussion. So I don't see this bill as pitting folks against each other. Initially, when this bill was drafted in previous iterations, it had the makeup of these committees was 60% nurses, 40% administration. It is now 50-50, and the goal is to have administration and nurses and other healthcare workers who are at the bedside have that conversation, hopefully come to agreement over how we can ensure safe staffing, which at the end of the day is what our patients need. So I don't see it as inherently adversarial, and it might just be the lawyer in me that I don't feel uncomfortable with having tough conversations. But I wanted to point that out. I also wanted to point out that this bill really isn't a one-size-fits-all in the way that California's bill is. And has been successful, but we didn't go that route because there was a lot of pushback. So this creates staffing committees at the hospital, at the unit, that really can look at the like acuity of the patient population, the level of experience of the various nurses who are on staff, and make those individualized determinations. So you know, that is the goal of the structure of Article 2. I also wanted to point out that emergencies do arise, and they emergencies arise, federal law requires that hospitals take in these patients, so this doesn't override the fact that emergencies happen and hospitals need to take in those patients. And I guess just I would end with the fact that the structure of Article 2, all of the minutiae, is not the point. The point is to give nurses a voice in staffing, which is what they currently don't have. All of these forms here, managers at the hospitals were notified. These forms didn't just go to the Minnesota Nurses Association. They went to the managers. And in one case, on one of these forms, they were given a pizza instead of another nurse that they needed. So that is the point of Article 2. I am a detail-oriented person. The Hospital Association is probably sick of me because I keep having hours of meetings with them that I have found to be very productive. We haven't grappled yet with Article 2, but I'm willing to, because the point isn't the exact structure here. The point is to give nurses a voice that they need to stay at the bedside, that the hospitals need to keep those nurses at the bedside. So I'm very much interested in continuing the conversation. That is my approach to legislation. I think it's the way to make the best bill.
All right.
Oh, and I would encourage
all right. To vote Thank now. You. Thank you, Representative Weiss. So the clerk will take the roll on the bill, and the chair votes no. I'm sorry, on the amendment, the A1 amendment.
Oh, yeah, not on the bill.
Not on the bill yet.
Liebling, no. Vice Chair Bierman.
Bierman, no.
Bierman, no. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Excuse me. Schumacher, aye. Representative Akam.
Akam, no.
Akam, no. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
No.
Bonner, no. Representative Carroll.
No.
Carroll, no. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, no.
Elkins, no. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, no.
Fisher, no. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
No.
Hemmingson-Yeager, no. Representative Herr. Excused. Representative Keel.
Keel, yes.
Keel, aye. Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Murphy, aye. Representative Nadeau.
Aye.
Nadeau, aye. Representative New Brindley. Excused. Representative Perryman.
Perryman, aye.
Perryman, aye. Representative Quam.
See.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
And Representative Ryer is voting remotely under our rules. And. Okay. Oh, she's not voting on this one? Okay.
Okay.
All right, we could come back to her if we get her.
Representative Ryer excused. Representative Smith.
No.
No.
Smith, no.
There being 7 ayes and 9 nays, the amendment, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. So we will go on to the bill. And so is there any other discussion to the bill? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Feist, for bringing this, truly. I've had a very interesting time meeting with nurses and talking about the issues, and I think there's a lot of valid points that they bring up for sure. There's a lot of this bill that I support. I mean, I support the loan forgiveness component, the violence prevention pipeline programs for new nurses and other healthcare professionals, changes that simplify licensure, money for mental health. I mean, there's a lot of really, really good things in this bill. Article 2 is a challenge for me, and I think it's a challenge for our hospitals. And, you know, it looks to me at the end of the day that, you know, ultimately, you know, we're going to come up with either hire more nurses or limit admissions. And that's frightening to me. I don't think it goes in the right direction. We heard testifiers talk about it's not the right size for rural, you know, rural Minnesota. That may be the case. I don't know rural Minnesota hospitals. I do know metro hospitals, and this is not the right size for metro hospitals either. The challenges that we face are massive. Nurses don't have all the right answers, nor do hospital administrators, and there's a process that they work through to try to make this happen. I heard from testifiers that, you know, the proponents of the bill really had, you know, it was more of a hopeless approach towards trying to find some solutions. In the second half, the proponents really had this hope that said, you know, we can achieve these things. We need to work together. And the problem that I'm having with this mostly is that a lot of these issues that are addressed in Article 2, these are collective bargaining components. And we just got done with collective bargaining. And, you know, trying to usurp that process and come to the legislature and say, you know what, now we want to put something new in place that we think will improve patient outcomes. And before I go on, I want to say I support increased nurses. I want more nurses in hospitals. I want to figure out a way to do that. And the fact that there was a testifier that talked about there was 5,000 openings statewide for nurses. I know that in my hospital, there's 125 open spaces right now for RNs in Hennepin Healthcare. I know that my hospital is going to spend $28 million this year on agency nurses. Hospitals don't want to do that. They don't want to spend twice as much. They don't. They want to be able to find that work-life balance that allows nurses to work to the level that they want and at the same time achieve those outcomes that they need. I mentioned it in when I spoke to Article 2, but I do feel that it fosters this combative situation. I also don't think that, you know, there was some testimony that talked about nurses, you know, voting on admissions. I don't agree with that in principle, but I also don't think that there's a nurse in the world that would vote against not admitting someone. So I'm not sure how, you know, what good that does. Moving on to the grading section of this bill, and I don't know what page it is in the new one. Basically, the grading factors. It's, you know, when we're talking about publishing grading compliance with core staffing plans, you know, I looked at this thing and I thought, you know, I always try to look at legislation as where can I find some common ground before I am too critical, and this was one that I was curious about, and maybe you want to talk to this a little bit. I'm not really sure, but you know, it goes down this list of number of assaults and injuries, emergency department wait times, restraints, behavioral initiatives. It goes down this whole list, and the thing that I found missing in this. To truly measure the value of a hospital and its and the complexity that it takes to improve patient outcomes, is there's nothing in here on, you know, morality. I mean, there is on readmissions, that's good, but what about safety of care? You know, patient experience, timeliness of care, efficient use of medical imaging, you know, decreasing, you know, death rates, decreasing, you know, ODs and EDs. There's a lot of ground that we didn't cover, and this just seems to be so punitive. And that's where I think there needs to be so much more work done to try to get to the point where we're actually going to find more nurses that can actually work with and improve patient outcomes. I appreciate the amendment that you brought that did address some of the concerns that hospitals have. I think there's a long way to go. Hopefully we can get it done this session. I really do. I will do everything I can to try to help and work towards that, but I just don't see the way that it's drafted right now that is that Article 2 is going to do anything to actually solve that challenge that we have of getting more nurses into the field. So I appreciate the work a lot, and I think a lot of it's really good, but the way it stands right now, it has too many problems for me, and I hope that we can solve them. I truly do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Doe. So I have now four more members on the list. I do want to say we have like six other bills, which are mostly short, and a lot of those are bills from the Hospital Association and others. They're probably not that controversial. I'd like to be able to get to them, but if every member wants to talk for 10 minutes, we're just not going to hear them. And I have to say we're kind of out of committee time, so not hearing them today may mean they don't get heard. I'm not going to tell any member they can't speak. You've all got the right to speak, but I just want you to understand that if we use all the time on this bill, we literally will not be able to take up some of the other bills that other people are very interested in. So, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think committee is where we do our work, and this is really important, so we do not want to force something to go faster than it should. That concerns me when we talk about running out of time, because I think in my early days we used to spend quite a bit of our evenings here. I like the testifiers, but I remember some late nights in committee. So my question, Representative Feist, is, you know, you made the comment that this won't change how hospitals accept patients. However, if a nurse group gets to decide, hospital and the nursing group gets to decide whether or not they're going to accept patients, what happens when they say no? No, that Keel is just a problem and we don't want her to come. And I would say there are probably some nurses that really don't want to see me, especially when I come with family. I'm a little bit of a mother bear. But I'm just really concerned that that could actually happen. What happens to the patient?
Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. You will be happy to hear that that is not how this bill would work. The members of these committees will vote on the larger staffing committee, and that is looking at large issues of staffing levels and how they connect to quality of care. Then there are the per unit workload committees, and that is where they will look more at these, you know, the like how high acuity the patient population is in that particular unit, the level of experience for the various nurses who would be on staff. But every day in every unit in hospitals across Minnesota, the staff who are there on the ground doing the work are going to make those important determinations about which patients will be seen. And I would also like to just point out that rationing is already occurring because units are being closed because there are not sufficient staffs. So this is already an issue. I have talked at great length with the hospitals about how important it is to address it. And I would like to point out just that this bill can't be considered in isolation because the hospitals have very real pressures and very real needs that we as a legislature should be considering. And so my hope is that we pass this bill, a robust form of this bill, and that we also do a lot to address the larger pressures that hospitals are facing right now.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair.
Representative Keel, we really don't have time for members to keep the floor and continue to ask questions and make statements. I'll give you a very brief follow-up. And then I'm going to go to Representative Smith.
Okay. I won't ask my question. I will say this, though. I was an 18-year-old that did aid work. And I believe that the hospitals need to have aides that can work in the hospital system to help the nurses. An aide can walk a patient. An aide can do many things that RNs do not have time for. And I think that is part of our issue with what is happening on our numbers. And I won't say any more. I guess we'll talk about this on the floor of the House. So thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think with these big controversial bills, when we talk about them, we forget to talk about the status quo, what we have right now. We've talked about management and nurses being pitted against each other. That's happening right now in every hospital in the state. Even in this room right now, we see there's nurses on one side, there's executive and staffing on the other. We know right now that we hear stress and burnout, chronic understaffing, working conditions being poor, management issues are the key leading indicators on why nurses aren't working. Why we have a staffing shortage in hospitals right now is not because we have a nursing shortage. Someone correct me if I'm wrong, I think we have an all-time high of nurses right now living in the state of Minnesota. It's because they can't work. They don't feel safe at work. They're not given the opportunity to succeed at work. And there is a big difference, I think, between testifiers who are for this bill and who are against this bill. Both have problems, certainly. Staffing, we heard a lot how hard that is to currently make that work in our hospital system. But the other side, we heard, are getting punched in the throat, literally. This is not something that we can continue to go forward, and it's not something we can just keep the status quo on. And I view Section 2 as doing the opposite of what it seems a lot of people are saying. It gives a voice to the nurses, and it unifies that management and voice of the nursers. It's 50-50 on those councils. It's not a one-size-fits-all. Each hospital is going to get to form their own. So rural hospitals that have more specific or particular needs will have their own voices in those staffing discussions, and even individual units will now have discussions. And those large staffing, they're not going to do day-to-day staffing, as we heard Rep. Vice say earlier. They're creating and implementing evaluations and updating the written core of how these things are happening. So I think there's a lot of solutions that we've had at the table for the very issues that are being brought forward. So this isn't the final form of this bill. I hope it'll be a strong form of this bill. I strongly support it. Happily be a co-author, and thank you at Feist for bringing it forward.
All right. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. A couple concerns with the bill. You know, the bill does ignore other health professionals, LPNs, and other essential workers like respiratory therapists and so forth. So that's a concern. The testimony that sit well, I mean, had the biggest, in my opinion, is Ms. Wagner. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. We in Greater Minnesota do this stuff. What she shared, going 142 miles in a blizzard, is what nurses, EMS, and healthcare people do. And we all know that. All you nurses. That's why you're doing this. But what we're doing, though, is we're not solving the problem. The solving the problem is what's in this bill. More safety. I've been in the back of an ambulance when people want to go after me, and I've been helping ER staff that people want to go after me. So, yes, I love the safety part of it. Loan forgiveness. Very smart. Mental health. One of the things that we have to work, and people in critical, out in rural Minnesota, critical access will know that EMS now has turned to a primary care, and we'll talk more about that tomorrow night. So we get what's going on. Article 2, and I know you've worked hard on this. I respect that. But Article 2 will make my job worse and my profession, other people who volunteer. We volunteer as EMTs, EMS, EMRs. This does not help us. And if we can work together, again, I respect your hard effort. But I'm already helping in the ER at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm already doing that. That's not what I'm called to do. But I do it because I care for my patient. Now, I'm not doing the doctor, but I'm performing the chest compressions. I'm doing what my level of training does because we're having staff problems. So I cannot support this bill. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Oh, roll call. I asked for a roll call, too, on this bill.
All right. There will be a roll call. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to say that, in general, especially Article 2, it just screams of overreach. I mean, it's about government compliance. It adds bureaucracy. And we're picking winners and losers because you heard the rural our hospitals are going to lose. Or we're going to lose on this because it's not going to work the way you think it is when we don't have any workers to go there. You know, it screams of overreach because we have the Commissioner of Labor involved. We have a $250,000 fine. Not petty. $250,000 fine. And, you know, if you really want it, and I want to help nurses, I mean, a lot of my friends are nurses, I want to help nurses, and they want to work. Well, maybe one thing we need to look at doing is relieving some of the mandates that have forced them out in the first place. So I think it's a poor bill, especially Article 2. The rest of it, I think, could make sense. But this is going to be extremely hard in rural Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Very brief final word, Representative Feist.
Very brief. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. Brief final word. I appreciate all of the conversation that we had today. Representative Nadeau and Representative Keel, I look forward to working with you on this. We do not need to have this conversation on the House floor because we can have it before then. Email me. I would love to work with you on it. And so just some final thoughts. This is not a ratio bill. I will say that again. It is not a top-down state-level one-size-fits-all solution. If individual hospitals and stakeholders have thoughts, they should come to me. I like to get into those level of details, and I want this bill to pass, and I want it to be workable for all. California did pass the staffing bill in 1999, and the result of it was that nurse employment has risen at a rate of twice the level as it is here in Minnesota. So we know that when we look at this issue, that we encourage nurses to be at the bedside where we need them. Just big picture. This bill and others that relate to it can meet the needs of both hospitals and nurses, and that is critically important, and we need to look at it both within the context of this bill and within the context of the work that you're doing on this committee. This is not a zero-sum game. We can look at the big picture, and we can find the ways to meet everyone's needs. This bill cannot be considered in isolation. As I said, the conversation continues. I want to continue that conversation. I want this bill to be awesome. I want it to achieve its intended goals. And what I heard from even folks who said they were uncomfortable with Article 2 is that they support nurses. And so I look forward to working with you to support hospitals and nurses. And lastly, I will just say that patients are at the heart of this bill. When we have safe staffing, we know that patient outcomes are directly tied to that staffing. There's materials that you've been provided as a committee that show peer-reviewed studies that demonstrate that staffing is directly tied to patient outcomes. And lastly, I would just say that the nurses are not hopeless. They are determined. They have come with a solution, and if hospitals have input on Article 2, I want to hear it at like a line-by-line level, because we can work together. We can do this. This is the year. I would encourage members to vote yes.
All right. The clerk will take the roll on the bill. I'm sorry. I should renew my motion that House File 1700, as amended, be re-referred to Labor and Industry Finance and Policy.
Chair Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Akam.
Aye.
Akam, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Bonner, aye. Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Carroll, aye. Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Aye.
And Hemmingson Yeager, aye. Representative Herr, excused. Representative Keel.
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Murphy.
Murphy, no.
Murphy, no. Representative Nadeau.
No.
Nadeau, no. Representative New Brindley, excused. Representative Perryman.
Perryman, no.
Perryman, no. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer.
Liz, yay or nay on the bill? Okay.
Oh.
Can you repeat that? I lost.
All right. We'll excuse her.
Used. Representative Smith.
Smith, aye.
Smith, aye.
There being 9 ayes and 7 nays, the bill is passed and on its way to Labor Committee. Thank you. All right. And please, we don't allow any applause in the hearing room. We'll next take up House File 1883, Representative Smith. Representative Smith moves that House File 1883 be laid over for possible inclusion. I would ask the audience, if you're leaving, we are still holding a committee hearing. Please leave quietly. No talking in the committee room, please. All right. Representative Smith's motion is that House File 1883 be laid over for possible inclusion. There is an A1 amendment. Representative Smith moves the A1 amendment. It just adds an effective date. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Smith, to your bill.
Thank you. This is a very simple bill. Right now, MA coverage for hospice care does not cover room and board services on an ongoing basis, and this bill will change that. Many in this room know how hard hospice care can be on loved ones, of the one who is in hospice, and this is to take off that financial burden as well. I can't say anything more than the testifying letter that you will find in your packets from one of my constituents who has a very sad story around this that I would encourage you to read. But other than that, it's a very simple bill to make sure those in hospice are not saddled with the financial burdens of paying for room and board.
All right. Thank you, Representative Smith. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone. Is there any member discussion? Representative Nadeau.
I just have one quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this need a fiscal note? Have you asked for a fiscal note on this?
Mr. Harney?
A fiscal note's been requested. One hasn't been completed.
All right. Other discussion, questions? All right. Seeing none, House Representative Smith renews his motion, and House File 1883, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Smith. All right, next we will take up House File 2077, Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman moves that House File 2077 be laid over for possible inclusion. I do not see an amendment to this one. Representative Bierman, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for hearing House File 2077. This is in regards to epilepsy and seizure detection treatment. Epilepsy is a condition defined by unprovoked recurring seizures. About 55,000 Minnesotans live with active epilepsy, and one-third of those live with uncontrolled epilepsy. Sudden, unexpected death in epilepsy is the leading cause of death in children and young adults with uncontrolled seizures. Those at highest risk of SUDEP are those who have convulsive seizures while unattended at night. Scientific evidence strongly supports that first aid during or shortly after convulsive seizures can be life-saving, and seizure detection devices ensure people with epilepsy are able to receive that attention as soon as possible. These devices are covered under some commercial plans, but not medical assistance fee-for-service. Covering these devices under medical assistance will ensure access to these potentially life-saving devices for people with seizures regardless of income. And Madam Chair, I do have a testimony.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Lloyd, and I am the CEO of the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota. Our mission is to lead the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. I'm here to speak in support of House File 2077, which covers seizure detection devices under medical assistance, advancing health equity in our state. Nationally, 50% of adults with active epilepsy have an annual family income, averages of less than $25,000 a year, and about 33% of people with epilepsy are covered under Medicaid. Seizure detection devices can reduce the risk of death and increase quality of life for people living with epilepsy. They alert caregivers when a seizure is occurring, so they're able to provide immediate first aid and mitigate potential complications. Potentially life-threatening complications, including sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, otherwise known as SUDEP, status epilepticus, suffocation, and or head injury. Sadly, one in 150 young adults ages 18 to 39 with uncontrolled seizures will die. One in 150. In addition to income inequities that exist in epilepsy, substantial racial inequities exist in access to care and in outcomes. According to research, African Americans are more likely to experience status epilepticus, and Black individuals had the highest age-adjusted death rate for epilepsy from 2005 to 2014. In addition, Black and multiracial infants and children were 1.5 times more likely to die from SUDEP than white infants and children. Please support House File 2077. Covering these devices under medical assistance will ensure that there are no financial barriers to accessing these potentially life-saving devices for individuals living with epilepsy. Thank you for your time and support of the epilepsy community. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you so much. Is there anyone else in the public here who would like to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone. Is there any member discussion? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I signed on to this bill, and I think it's remarkable to be able to detect seizures and help family as they live with this. But I'm wondering, will there be any challenges with the federal approval? Have you looked into that at all?
Yes, this is only for FDA.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, Chair.
Let's do it. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Chair, Representative, this is only for FDA-approved devices. So there is a device already on the market that is FDA-approved.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Backer.
Yeah, well, Madam Chair, my quick question is how many other states are providing this type of product care?
Representative Bierman or Mr. Loy?
Currently, this would be the first in the nation.
That's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Any final word, Representative Bierman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that this is something that will help patients, it will save lives, it will help families and caregivers, and I do appreciate the support of Representative Keel and Representative Nadeau on this bill. Thank you, and ask for your support.
All right, thank you. And with that, Representative Bierman renews his motion, and House File 2077 is laid over for possible inclusion. All right, thank you very much. We will now go to House File 2081, Representative Akam. Representative Akin moves that House File 2081 be laid over for possible inclusion. And there is an amendment in the packet, and I assume the author wants to move the amendment right now. So Representative Akin moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So the A2 is adopted. And to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill has come before the committee several times since 2018. And in 2021, this committee and the legislature directed the Department of Human Services to convene a stakeholder group to design what recuperative care should look like in Minnesota. This bill is reflective of that work and this broad group of stakeholders. Recuperative care as a national model looks very different in every state. It provides short-term care for people who are unhoused, who are not ill enough to be in the hospital, yet too ill to recuperate on the streets. It's usually a partnership between a healthcare provider and a shelter where medical staff provide limited care. In Minnesota, is currently paid through a patchwork of funding. This bill before you directs Minnesota to pay for recuperative care through Medicaid that includes care coordination, basic nursing care, community health workers, and behavioral health support. It defines who can receive recuperative care, what services will be provided and where, and how it will be paid for, and a report back to the legislators. We have heard about all the challenges of hospital discharge and overcrowding. The estimated daily cost in the hospital when a patient doesn't need to be there is around $2,500 a day, compared with around $350 a day for recuperative care. One day in the hospital could pay for an entire week of recuperative care, 1 month of unnecessary hospitalization for one person could pay for three individuals to each access a full 60 days of recuperative care. I have a couple testifiers that are joining me today, Madam Chair.
All right, so we'll go to the testifiers, and I just have to ask the testifiers to be very brief. I'm sorry, but Will Nicholson, welcome.
My name is Will Nicholson, Madam Chair, members.
And if you would pull the mic down a little bit there. Thank you.
Is this better?
Perfect.
Okay. I am a family physician and hospitalist, so this is a case near and dear to my heart.
I practice in the East Metro, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Medical Association. And I am testifying on behalf of the MMA, which includes more than 10,000 physicians and physicians in training in the state. And we are strongly in support of HF 2081. Because so much of what happens outside of our clinics and hospitals impacts the health status of Minnesotans, housing insecurity and homelessness is a huge issue. It is a major social driver of illness in our state, and about 20,000 people in Minnesota are unhoused every year. Nobody should have to face homelessness, and a lack of housing especially is risky for patients who are recovering from illness, the kind of patients I take care of every day. For most people discharged from the hospital, they have a home to go to, family and caregivers to look out for them. Someone who is discharged and does not have a home has an infinitely more difficult time recovering. Let me give you some statistics. Patients experiencing homelessness are twice as likely to be readmitted within a week of discharge from the hospital. Homelessness makes people more likely to be admitted to the hospital with high risk, advanced, and more costly conditions. And in addition, patients experiencing homelessness overall are at risk of earlier death and greater debility compared to those who have stable housing. To ensure that Minnesotans experiencing homelessness can receive needed short-term care in their recovery from hospitalization, we are in strong support of expanding medical assistance coverage to include recuperative care. This bill helps accomplish that, and it could provide for people who are experiencing homelessness a tremendous amount of care that would improve their outcomes and will also help us with, as was mentioned, hospital overcrowding, ED overcrowding, and help it drive care towards primary care. Besides that, it's the right thing to do. So on behalf of the physicians in Minnesota, let's do this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Amy Gordon, and then we'll have John Potter, if he's present. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Amy Gordon, nurse practitioner with Hennepin County Healthcare for the Homeless. Healthcare for the Homeless is a shelter and outreach-based federally qualified healthcare center which provides physical and mental health care to individuals experiencing homelessness. One embedded program Healthcare for the Homeless provides is medical recuperative care in partnership with Catholic Charities. Imagine the last time you were sick, broke a bone, or recovering from a surgery or hospitalization. Now imagine doing that with no place to sleep, no running water or toilet access, limited food resources, or while carrying your own possessions. Would you have been able to heal, or would you likely have gotten worse? In the Healthcare for the Homeless Medical Recuperative Care Program, we provide essential services to support the rest and recovery for immediate healthcare concerns like pneumonia, jaw fracture, finger amputation, or exacerbations of chronic health conditions like congestive heart failure or a diabetic foot ulcer. The care we provide shows a reduction of higher level services being accessed and allows our clients to get the health and social service needs back on track. Here is how things will change across the state of Minnesota with this bill. When a patient is in recuperative care, we will be able to provide care coordination, basic nursing care, community health workers, and basic behavioral health support. These are all critical pieces to helping an individual heal physically and mentally so they can stabilize their lives and see a brighter future. I strongly encourage you to pass this bill. It is common sense, and we know what to do to step into this healthcare gap. We cannot wait another year to establish this service when there are people right now who desperately need it. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. John Potter. Welcome to the committee.
Afternoon. Barely there. Learned how to walk and talk again.
You're doing great.
Yeah. I'm John Potter. After a few years of fighting the virus, I needed found myself stuck in the COVID cracks, needing and seeking services that I knew were out there, but I didn't know quite how to find them. I've worked at built bridges for about 35 years here in town. Probably ran across one or two of them today. It ends up that the very buildings that I helped build a decade ago actually have the services and stuff that I was seeking. I call it the med bed, the old boy, for a guy that was always doing things on his own, not thinking I ever needed any help. Where do you start when you pretty much come to, a nursing home? When you last remember, you were on your way to work, Wow, where did 2 years go? But anyways, how do you start the whole process of, first off, you're going to have a lot of people trying to help you. Not all of it's going to be good help, and you can get ate up real fast. That deal downtown, they've got processes, it's neat. Everything's within a 2-block area of who I need to see, what buttons I need to push, and things happen. And, 3 months ago, literally went in with nothing, and already I've got, my Social Security things, signed up. I've got appointments with regular doctors. I know where their offices are at, how to get to them, and things are starting to maybe be a good year. There's a lot of people out there that are in worse shape than me. I've seen them. I wish they'd find the same snow trail I did. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Mr. Potter, thank you very much for coming down to testify. Appreciate that. Is there anyone else in the public who would like to testify on this bill? Not seeing anyone. Is there any member discussion to the bill? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just be super quick. Thank you for bringing this bill. It's important. I mean, this is one of those things where this is a model of care that's been piloted. It's been proven to reduce costs. It improves outcomes, and it just as importantly steps patients down, freeing up space in our hospitals. So this is one of those incredibly effective tools that that we've partnered successfully on, and it's working. So thank you for bringing this bill.
All right. Thank you. Final word, Representative Akam.
Thank you so much for the time to present today, and I urge your support.
All right. Thank you so much. So with that, House File 2081 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, we're going to take up Representative Wolgemuth's bill, House File 2749. And so the chair will move that House File 2749 be laid over for possible inclusion. And, there is the DE, but I think, Representative Wolgemuth, did we want to just, you want to just present the bill as it is, and then we could just discuss the DE? Is that's what we're going to do, right?
I think that's a great plan, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. So why don't you go ahead then? The bill is moved, and go ahead and present the bill.
Well, Madam Chair and members, thank you so much for the opportunity to present House File 2749. Out of respect for your time, my testifiers and I have very much cut out a lot of what we were going to present, but we'll make sure that you get the gist of the bill. We're bringing this bill forward, Madam Chair and members, because there's been a disturbing trend of increased incidences of violent acts committed against healthcare workers. In fact, Madam Chair, the World Health Organization has stated that nearly 40% of those who work in healthcare roles have suffered a physical act of violence at some point in their career, and it doesn't even capture those on the receiving end of verbal aggressions. That's unacceptable. That's why we're putting forward House File 2749 to request $20 million in funding from the Healthcare Access Fund for provider types in the state to pursue a competitive grant to make safety enhancements in their locations. The language in Section 1 is intentionally flexible to meet unique needs. The funding here could allow a dental clinic to provide de-escalation training for its staff, allow a hospital to address multiple access points, allow a long-term care facility to implement a violence intervention program. But the three main areas we're focusing here are on grants and programs to train staff on de-escalation and self-defense, finance infrastructure improvements, or invest in IT improvements. The amendment that will be moving later includes additional distribution parameters that came forward after discussion with the Department of Health and the Coalition. That's the gist of the bill, Madam Chair. That's why we're bringing it forward. We want our healthcare workers to know they're recognized and we understand their concerns. We want them to be safe. With that, Madam Chair, I have some testifiers who can shed further light and provide further information on the importance of House File 2749.
Very good. Thank you so much, Representative Wolgamott. So we will go to testifiers. And Casey Clements, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, for the opportunity to speak on behalf of our broad coalition in favor of this bill. My name is Dr. Casey Clements, and I am an emergency physician, and I serve as the staff safety officer for Mayo Clinic, working on workplace violence since 2014. The most recent data available to us from the Bureau of Labor Statistics in 2018 shows that 74% of all non-fatal workplace violence injuries in the entire country happen in healthcare. That makes it among the most dangerous professions that you can go into. I can tell you about the frequency and severity of those injuries and that they are increasing significantly now. I could sit here today and quote astronomical numbers of assaults that are happening daily in hospitals across our state, but in truth, we don't understand the breadth and the depth of the problem. According to the best available published evidence, only 19% of violent acts, physically violent acts, are ever reported. This doesn't even hint at the fear and trauma from verbal abuse, harassment, intimidation, and threats that are far more common than when patients strike us. We know that violence has fundamentally changed the way that we interact with patients, that staff are suffering post-traumatic stress symptoms at astronomical levels, and that a very high number of healthcare professionals have considered leaving their job due to violence, something that everyone should be paying attention to in the current staffing shortage. We are caught up in an epidemic of violence against healthcare professionals that's gotten much worse since the COVID-19 pandemic. And yes, we have shown that the pandemic has increased violence against healthcare providers. Instead, I want to tell you of the personal toll that this has played on the people who choose to take care of all of us when we're sick or hurt. I can tell you of doctors who have gone home after a shift, packed up their families, and gone to stay in a hotel because of personal threats against them. I can tell you about security guards who have broken bones from violence inflicted intentionally, some of which will hurt for the rest of their lives, and about nurses and PCAs who are bruised and battered by dementia patients who have no idea what they're doing, but in systems that are not designed to care for the staff or that patient. HF 2749 is a necessary first step, and I urge you to please support it and future workplace violence efforts. I'm available for questions. Thank you
so much for your testimony. Matt Horace, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson and committee. My name is Matthew Horace. I'm the Chief Security Officer for the Mayo Clinic, a position I've held for the past 4 years. I'm a 27-year veteran of federal, state, and local law enforcement. I understand violence and I understand victims. My role at the Mayo Clinic is to provide security strategy and oversight to people, process, and technology that will promote a safe and healing environment for the millions of patients that come to the Mayo Clinic for hope. My role is also to provide security and safety oversight to the most important asset that we have, our employees, our physicians, our nurses, our technicians, all of our point of care personnel, and oh, by the way, our security officers who come to work every day to ensure that we provide world-class health care. Within my own staff, officers who have honorably served in United States military assignments have been seriously injured in the healthcare environment in violent patient interactions. We know that you can't provide world-class health care if you don't feel safe. We have access control and video programs and committees, policies and procedures. What we don't have most often is the ability to predict or foreshadow when a seemingly calm patient or visitor is going to move onto a path of violence. To that end, based on the uptrending data available, not just my organization, but all healthcare organizations throughout the United States need support and help. We must pull out all the stops, remove the barriers, and add additional tools to our collective toolboxes. I support and hope that you can support this bill.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. And I understand there's a letter in our – oh, okay. All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? All right. I'm not seeing anybody. Is there any member discussion? Okay. I'm not seeing any of that either. Well, Representative Wolgamott, thank you very much for carrying the bill. And obviously, if from those who listen to our whole testimony today or so far, we've had a lot of discussion about this very problem. I don't know whether a little bit more money in the system helps, but certainly we need to do some things, and probably we need a lot of different strategies to try to address this, because it is, as we heard, extremely serious. So thank you for bringing the bill today. And then let me just the amendment that's in the packet, the DE1, let me just offer that for a second, and then I'll withdraw it. But so this is just fleshes out the bill a little bit more. As you look at the bill itself, it doesn't have a lot of parameters in it, and what the DE1 does is just offer some more parameters around how the money would be used and so on. So I'm going to withdraw that. It's just really here for discussion purposes. But the bill is going to be laid over, so discussion can continue. And with that, House File 2749 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. So thank you very much, Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I appreciate it.
All right, and thank you to the testifiers. Moving on to Representative Bierman, House File 1574. Representative Bierman is going to move that House File 1574 be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Bierman, I don't think there's an amendment, so please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. House File 1574 addresses commercial tobacco use, which remains the leading cause of preventable death and disease. Members, smoking costs the state of Minnesota $7 billion a year, and in Minnesota, medical assistance program alone, smoking-related health care costs total $563 million annually. This bill would ensure medical assistants and Minnesota Care enrollees have a comprehensive tobacco cessation benefit that includes coverage for individual group and phone counseling and all FDA-approved medications. Tobacco addiction is a chronic relapsing condition that often requires multiple attempts to quit and repeated individualized treatment. This bill would allow more providers trained in tobacco counseling to be reimbursed, including mental health specialists and alcohol and drug counselors, ensuring that patients can see their trusted provider for tobacco treatment. Madam Chair, that's the brief version. We could have member questions or discussions, and if I need some more testifiers, I can call them from the audience.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. So, I know you did have a testifier. That person still want to testify? Okay. We can.
Nope.
All right. Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Okay, member discussion. Representative Nadeau.
I'm assuming that you've requested a fiscal note and it just isn't here.
Yes, Mr. Harney is nodding his
head. Do we have any idea, is this a huge cost? Or, I mean, do we have any... Any idea? Was it introduced before?
Mr. Harney.
Last year, there was a fiscal note completed on a similar bill. It was approximately $30,000 a fiscal year. It had to do with an analysis of the previous annual claims for tobacco cessation drugs that would now be covered. and that was the amount estimated then.
Right. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. So sounds like a pretty small cost for a pretty important thing. But, of course, we don't have our budget targets yet. But, you know, lay the bill over. And of course, it's important to always remember that there are a lot of the health care disparities that exist. A lot of our low-income population, if we can improve things like smoking rates, we can, you know, help to make a dent in that disparities problem that we have. So thank you. Other discussion from members? All right, seeing none. So House File 1574 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Representative Bierman. And the final bill that we have today is Representative Ryer's bill, House File 2090. And Representative Ryer, unfortunately, is home ill today. So I'm going to move House File 2090, that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And let's see, I don't think there's an amendment on this one. And so Mr. Eckert is here from the Hospital Association, and I'm just going to let him present the bill. And go ahead, Mr. Eckert.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Danny Eckert, and I serve as the Director of State Government Relations for the Minnesota Hospital Association. I want to thank Representative Ryer for carrying this bill. Unfortunately, she can't be here today. Hope she's feeling better. Minnesota Department of Health Summer Healthcare Internship Program, or SHIP, is a proven program that offers paid internships through grants to hospitals, clinics, nursing facilities, and home care providers for secondary and post-secondary summer healthcare seeking healthcare internships. For your reference, to be brief, included in your member packets today are a one-pager and a chart book on the program and this bill that provides more details on this bill and for your reference. The purpose of the program is to expose interested high school, secondary, and post-secondary students to various careers within the healthcare profession. The program has been oversubscribed for multiple years running and is not able to meet demand for both the would-be interns as well as the eligible providers seeking grants to the program. Since 2014, 1,275 interns have participated in the program. However, the program has not been able to support roughly 1,000 additional interns in that same time. I think that the appropriation in this bill would cover those 1,000 going backwards, so that's just a reference for what this would do going forward. So in closing, I urge this committee to support House File 2090 and increase the ability of the Summer Healthcare Internship Program to foster interest amongst our state's secondary and post-secondary students in pursuing a healthcare career and expand the pipeline for Minnesota's desperately needed healthcare workforce.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Eckert. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? I don't see anyone. Member discussion. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it looks like it's a 50% increase in the funding. Is that correct?
Mr. Eckert?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, current funding per year is at $300,000 for the three-year RFP grant cycle. The appropriation of this bill would add an additional one-time $450,000 per fiscal years 24 and 25, so a total appropriation of $900,000.
Representative Kwan?
Okay, so it'd be we would be spending 250% of what currently was spent. Is this going to be broadening it to different regions? Including, I'm just trying to understand when you more than, you know, do a huge increase, is because it was localized and now you're doing it across the state. Just help me understand that. Thank you.
Mr. Eckert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam, this is a statewide program. I can follow up with you with more information on which hospitals, nursing homes, home care facilities, and clinics that are participating. We have, there's a letter of support from St. John's, from Albert Lea, and so we have rural, urban, and this program, again, is seeking to attract our adolescent high school students and other secondary students to take the career path towards an education in healthcare and serving as our future healthcare workforce. So we intend, and I will follow up with more information on the scope and we would love to increase this as far and wide for every corner of the state.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's just, you know, this doesn't seem like a lot of money, but if we're expanding it so much, then I think the committee members should understand where we're increasing it, so we can, when we include it in a bill, maybe add some details if that'd be appropriate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Quam. And Mr. Eckert, I assume that the money amount is scalable, and could you just maybe say briefly why this amount was landed on?
So, Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, this amount, so we have, to be clear, MHA is the procured steward of this grant. It has been since 1998. So I do have available data from our grants team. And over the last 5 years, the average amount requested that was not funded falls right around to an additional $450,000 per year for interns. So this would cover requests on average from the last 5 years for additional interns. So this is scaled to what we know current and increasing demand for the program is from providers. So we're trying to, it's level set to that demand. And to answer your question more precisely, Madam Chair, it is scalable.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Eckert, for bringing the bill forward and getting this on the agenda today. And despite Mr. Ryer's non-ability to attend, that you step in over this important program. It intersects with what that first bill we had today was. We need people in the facilities. We need to spark interest. We need to address workforce. So thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Any other discussion? All right. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2090 be laid over, and the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Eckert. Thank you, Representative Ryer, who I know is actually listening.
Thank you, Representative Ryer.
So, all right. So thank you, members. We have, I think, completed our agenda for today. Hallelujah. We are adjourned.